I'm Spencer.
And I'm Andrew, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today we'll be speaking with Ifeoma Azoma, a policy expert and equity advocate, who's the founder of the Santa Fe-based consulting firm Earthseed.
Ifeoma's work focuses on issues of tech accountability, public policy, and health misinformation. In 2020, she was awarded the Bold Prize, and she's on the First Draft Inc. Board of Directors and is also a member of the Brookings Institution's Transatlantic Working Group on Disinformation.
In our continued effort to understand the forces and policies behind the issues of our time, Ifeoma has been both personally and professionally on the front lines. Her perspective at this time is incredibly valuable. Let's get her on the line. Hi, Ifeoma. Welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you with us today.
Thank you so much.
So what's at the top of your mind right now? What's at the top of your mind today?
Oh, man. Okay, this is not work related, but I was looking up composters this morning because I have 7 baby chickens and the coop that I ordered for them is coming. And so I was thinking about composting because I also have a garden.
Which is not, you know, you're not the only one at this time. We made the mistake of buying the wrong compost a few months ago. The black plastic one that spins, not the one you want. Apparently, the legit way to do it is just have a pile in your yard with a fence around it.
I can't do a pile because I have badgers, raccoons, bears, deer, mountain lion. Someone saw one down the street 2 days ago, so I can't. Oh, and pack rats, which until I moved to Santa Fe, I did not realize was anything other than a euphemism for people who keep junk. No, pack rats are a real animal.
And they're large.
And they're large. They're large and they're freaky. I mean, they're kind of cute, but they're freaky. So, yeah, no.
Welcome to your new life in New Mexico.
Thank you.
So I want to start, and the reason we wanted to have you on today was about a lot of the advocacy work you've been doing in the last couple of years. And so I wanted to just start for the listeners to go back to October 2019, when the civil rights activist group Color of Change reached out to your employer at the time and requested that they stop promoting and romanticizing former slave plantations as wedding venues. What happened next?
Oof. Well, what happened before, I think, is sort of relevant to what happened next, because since September of the previous year, 2018, I had raised concerns about pay discrimination that I was experiencing, gave the company, Pinterest, quite a bit of time to address them. They did not. So in May of 2019, I hired a lawyer. In June of that same year, I was doxxed by a white supremacist colleague who was working with Project Veritas. He's now fully employed by them. He even went on Tucker Carlson's show, talked about me, two other female colleagues. And there were a number of people involved in the decision that he didn't like, but he picked the 3 women who were part of it. And
for those who might not know, before you go too far, what is doxxed?
He shared my photo, my cell phone number, my email, all of the identifying information that you could need with Project Veritas, who then shared it on their socials. It ended up on 4chan, 8chan. It was on Reddit, Gateway Pundit comments, everywhere on the internet that you definitely don't want your information, especially if you're a Black woman. That year had been a lot. So then in October, when Color of Change, who I'd worked with on a number of projects, reached out and said, hey, you guys are still promoting slave plantations as wedding venues. This is wrong. I shared the information with the relevant team, said, you know, for what it's worth, I agree, this is wrong, and then left it for the teams who manage content policy and trust and safety to decide. That was when the pushback started. I was told that I was pushing an agenda, which I thought was interesting. I don't know what agenda they were referring to, but that I was pushing an agenda, and then the teams in charge and the leadership, really, because the folks who were under management were totally on board. So this was really a leadership level issue. Then made a decision to take all of the recommendations that I gave after Color of Change made clear they were talking to BuzzFeed and BuzzFeed was going to publish a story on it. So at the point that it became then a PR issue, then all of the recommendations I had made the month before were taken. A funny wrinkle that I didn't realize until after all of this happened was that the woman who pushed back the most on me was actually married on a slave plantation. And the announcement is still online from her wedding. This is made for TV.
The amazing thing is there are so many wedding photographs out there of large families standing under the biggest tree on the plantation. I mean, awful. And so just this very small issue is something that people don't understand how deep and dark a wedding on a slave plantation actually is and how it's memorialized often in the family photograph.
Yeah. And I even took the empathetic approach that, you know, like maybe it's certainly if you went through the American school system, public or private, you may not understand how bad slavery was or that slave plantations were mass torture sites. So I compared it to concentration camps. We would not think it's appropriate to throw a party or a wedding somewhere like Auschwitz. Just absolutely not. Because we have not reckoned with our past the way that Germany has and many European countries have. We treat them differently, even though they're not really that different. And then I was told that that was inappropriate for me to say and that I shouldn't have made the comparison. So there is no winning. But the company did win because the company decided to take the recommendations that I made. And there were over 75 positive headlines with Pinterest right in the headline because of the decision that was made. And even after that, my manager, who had already been discriminating against me, absolutely should not have been part of any performance review process that I was in because the company was engaging with my legal counsel at that point. Was still in charge of my performance reviews, which determined my pay, and he docked me in my performance reviews because of my work on the slave plantation decision.
And in that performance review, he actually had asked you to deal with it a little bit differently. What did he say?
He said that I should have provided the pros and the cons for promoting slave plantations. So I, as a Black woman who had already explained, like, here, this isn't even me suggesting this. This is Color of Change. I'm agreeing with their suggestion based on the 3 pages of research that they just provided to us, doing my job as the public policy manager who engaged with outside groups. He felt that I should have still provided the pros for promoting slave plantations.
And you couldn't come up with any.
I can't think of any. No, couldn't then, can't now.
So next, you had to make a choice.
Yeah, I mean, and next is even hard. I was talking to my therapist recently about how crazy the year and a half that I had legal counsel while at Pinterest was, because on any given day, my schedule would be like on one day, I had a Public Radio International interview. I was on The World talking about the health misinformation work that I was leading. That same day, I had a meeting with my lawyer because he had just heard back from Pinterest counsel, employment counsel, about how I should be grateful about the pay I was receiving and I had no case whatsoever. That same person, the employment counsel, was on my team because I was on the legal team and no one had recused themselves from my case. So we had a team meeting that day. So then at a large round table, I was sitting across from the employment counsel who just told my lawyer basically that I'm ungrateful and I should shut my mouth, next to the general counsel, who's my manager's manager and the one making all of these decisions. She also manages the whole team. I mean, the whole thing was an ethics mess and exactly why it's been in the news since last year when I went public, because it's just sort of unbelievable that a publicly traded company would be running things like this. And it's part of why the shareholder lawsuit that was filed by the Rhode Island Pension Fund is such a big deal.
Right.
They're going through the legal proceedings, and the pension fund that did this, along with the firm that they're working with, has a successful track record of suing large tech companies. They got $300 million settlement from Google based on similar things. There wasn't nearly as much documentation in the Google case. And so this is a mess for Pinterest that could have been avoided. I gave them so much time to avoid it, and they just chose not to.
So you left that job.
Yes.
And you ventured out into the world. What did you do next? I mean, first of all, incredibly traumatic, and what you describe, and I'm not sure people understand the level of trauma that someone goes through when they're under that kind of pressure in a confrontation at all times, and they have to switch gears between things that are ultimately a confrontation of yourself. Like, it's personal. It's not business, and you want to put your business hat on, but there's no difference, right? And so when I was reading about what you were going through, I was thinking a lot about what were you going through personally at that time, you know, in your own mind, and how are you getting through the day, honestly? How are you not having panic attacks?
Oh, God. Well, I had a few. The first one that I had where I was like, oh, shit, this feels like I'm having a heart attack. This is not great. Was the day that my lawyer FedExed the demands letter in May to Pinterest. Again, I sit on the legal team, and so there should have been an automatic refusal of folks. But the general counsel, because open office spaces and tech companies trying to save money and pretend it's about collaboration, I sat across from the general counsel. I stand at a standing desk, or did when I was in an office. And so I'm standing looking at her face when her admin hands her the demands letter with my lawyer's letterhead on the top of it. So I walked to the bathroom because I was like, I'm going to pass out. I can't be here for this.
This is a movie. I mean, it's...
No, it is. It is. And then when I came back to my desk, she had handed it to the employment counsel, who sat three desks away from me, who's highlighting it while she has my lawyer's website up on her computer. And I saw the whole thing. So that was the first serious panic attack that I had. Outside of that, I think I handled it without dying or ending up in the hospital, because my mom died when I was in college. It was my sophomore year at Yale. Yale at that time, and I learned, unfortunately, recently, still has the same policy of not allowing people to take a semester off. And so I had to do my finals. She died in February. And I still had to take all of my classes and do my finals, or they were going to force me to take a full year off. I thought, oh my God, of course this barbaric practice has changed. Like, they have a more flexible policy. And I learned recently, unfortunately, from a friend from Anchorage, I grew up in Anchorage, Alaska, as a child, that someone she knows, who was a freshman at Yale, who's from Anchorage, recently died by suicide because she had asked to take time off and the school had not allowed her to. So yeah, I've been through worse technically. And so part of it was just dissociating.
Yeah.
In February, late February, the very last work trip that I was on, I was invited by the National Academies of Sciences to DC to present at a symposium they held on health misinformation. So I'm sitting at a table, and it's actually one of the more surreal things that I've experienced, because it was right at the beginning of the pandemic, a bunch of public health officials, some of the folks who are still part of the response now, and we're talking about how none of us are going to travel again after this conference. And I was sitting there thinking, I don't know that I'm gonna have a job long after this conference, because we had already scheduled mediation for first week of March. So as soon as I came back, we then had the mediation, and that same day they cut off my access to all of my internal documents. I had to hand over my computer, my badge, whole nine. Yeah.
Because you had done something wrong.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was their stance. And yeah, it's funny, they've made all of these changes, spent millions of dollars to address this. And Ben Silberman, the CEO, still can't bring himself to say, you know, I think we fucked this one up. I don't understand what it would take from him to say, you know, I'm the leader of this company. I started this and I fell short because I wasn't aware of what my direct reports were doing, or I was aware and I took wrong guidance, or I just made the wrong decision here. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's the first example of power being confronted with truth. you know, it's tough to retain power and the truth at the same time. And I think we see that a lot broadly in leadership, especially in the Valley. But I wanted to, I have so much to ask, but one other thing that I'm curious about that moment was when the pandemic hit and things got crazy. And I know it's a weird question, but did you feel a bit of relief? Like, oh, so the rug just got pulled from under me, but also the whole world. So like, welcome to the party.
Oh, yeah.
Did you feel like we're all in this together now?
Well, I was like, you know, I mean, this is the most utter shit show ever. But also, I don't actually have to explain to anyone immediately, like, why I'm not working. And a number of people actually thought, because I had been in a role where I'm doing things where I'm giving interviews, I'm doing public panels. I was very much a public figure for my role. And so one of my biggest concerns, which I realize now is so silly and sort of vain, was, are people going to think that I just am not capable of doing my job because they're not hearing anything anymore? Like, what are they going to think of me, was my honest thought. And then I realized, oh, no one's asking because everyone is freaking out right now. No one's in the office. Everyone's like, how do I get back home? How do I leave the city? And so there were a number of people who reached out to me who I worked with or worked with their teams at Pinterest after I went public in June, who were like, shit, I thought you were on medical leave. Like, I didn't even know you were gone. I did not realize you had left the company. And I thought it was weird that I hadn't heard anything from you for a while, but a lot of people went sort of quiet. And so there were folks who didn't know that I had left until they learned exactly why.
Until the famous tweet dropped.
Right.
So what gave you the courage to post that tweet that much later? I mean, you gave yourself time. I imagine you went through a period of trying to understand what the hell was going on in your life, what you'd been through, what it meant to you, how to integrate it somehow. And then you tweeted that with such courage.
Yeah.
I'm curious what led to you actually hitting go on that.
I mean, a number of things. I never really held my tongue. So I was going to say something at some point. Pinterest actually sped up the timeline. My last official day was May 20th. Although they took my computer first week of March, I was on leave from March till the end of May. And so when I spoke, I think it was June 15th, maybe, that I tweeted. That was because I think the week before or 2 weeks before, Pinterest posted this bullshit middle of the night. It literally was the middle of the night on the East Coast, Black Lives Matter statement that I later learned was only drafted because Black employees at the company and allies had forced the issue, because at that point, something like 200 companies had already issued statements and Pinterest still hadn't said anything. And so employees pushed it. Comms came up with this mealy-mouthed BS that they posted on the internal blog and then on Twitter. And I read that, and there, I think there was a line that said, Black employees matter. And I was like, come again? You gotta be kidding me. And so at that point, I started drafting along with and spoke with a former colleague, Erica Shimizu Banks, who had experienced the same exact thing, and told her, I'm writing this. So she started writing one as well. And we had the same legal counsel who I had hired before she even started. And I let him know, I was like, look, I know you're risk averse. This is your job as a lawyer. I want you to take into account the experience that, you know, I have working with reporters. I know how to do this properly. And the way to manage my own story is to share first and then give interviews. But then also, I just want you to read this to make sure I'm not sued the second that I tweet it. If they decide to sue later, we'll deal with that. And he was like, you know, I mean, they could, like, at any point, they could sue you.
I mean, you were under non-disparagement and non-disclosure that are incredibly broad.
That's correct.
And so a big topic of today's discussion is going to be about the non-disclosure. You were aware of that and you're aware of the broadness of it.
Mm-hmm.
What mitigation of risk were you considering related to the NDA when you did this?
Well, both broad and specific. The non-disparagement clause, which I think was like three quarters of one of the many pages in the whole agreement that I signed, was pretty specific about never speaking to the media in any way that makes Pinterest or Pinterest shareholders look bad. So, I mean, that's as clear cut as you can get. And I had one protection, kind of. So in 2019, a California law went into effect called the STAND Act, CCP 1001. It's in the Civil Code of Procedures. And what it did was create a carve out for gender-based discrimination, harassment, and assault mm-hmm. in the workplace. That came from the Harvey Weinstein mess and Me Too and a bunch of actresses, honestly, in Southern California pushing for change at the state legislature. And a number of states passed similar laws around that time. What that did was provide coverage for the gender-based claims that I had and that I had filed, but not the race. Mm. And I can't disentangle being a woman from being Black, and that the harassment and the retaliation and the wage discrimination that I faced was at the intersection of both. So knowing that they could sue me, I decided to still speak up. And the gamble, the legal gamble that we took was, well, if they sue, they would have to sort of admit that the discrimination that I faced and that they tried to silence me about was race-based and not gender-based, because it's against the law for them to silence me on the gender stuff. So I don't think that they're going to do that, but there was always the possibility. And there still is. Like at any point, there are so many other stories that I would love to tell about what happened there. But some of them I learned secondhand from other people on the team who were privy to conversations that I weren't. Those don't feel covered, and so I am not sharing them, but maybe one day.
I wanted to mention that, you know, as with most employees at major tech firms, you were kind of forced into signing this NDA by reason of being an employee there. And this includes discrimination, harassment, basically not speaking out about anything. Did you consider this when you signed it? And do you think people understand the true nature of an NDA, that it's effectively a gag order?
So no, I don't think people understand that. But also, how many choices do people have at the start of employment? So there are two scenarios, and often others, where people are faced with NDAs, which stands for non-disclosure and non-disparagement. The disparagement part usually comes later at the separation point. But at the start of employment, you either sign or you don't start. So, I mean, you don't really have an option unless your option was to just not be employed. Mm-hmm. And actually, there was a ruling yesterday in New York, I think, about a former Trump campaign staffer who spoke up about their experience after. And the Trump campaign, incredibly litigious, went after this individual. And the court ruling was that you can't have these, actually, it was a federal court ruling, but that you can't have overbroad employment agreements. It was unfortunately very narrowly ruled for just this employee and just this contract. But essentially what the contract said, which was egregious, but the exact same as every tech company I've worked for, was that you can't talk about anything. If you see it, if you come across it, if you learn it at any point during employment, you can't talk about it. Mm. And what people, I mean, the business argument for that is, well, intellectual property, confidentiality. But I signed, I think, three or four separate agreements at the start of my employment at Pinterest. And one of them was specifically about IP and confidential information. So then including the non-disclosure aspect in everything else that you sign to is unnecessary. Mm-hmm. There are already specific carve-outs. There's a whole section where you're supposed to write down any inventions you have, any projects you're working on, so that they understand what was yours before you came in or what intellectual property you had before you started employment, so that if they sue you for anything you come up with while you're there, they can say, well, you didn't list it. Mm. So there's no reason for these overbroad non-disclosure agreements. And then at the point of separation, one of the things that I've been doing a bunch of lobby calls with California legislators who are on the Senate Judiciary Committee for the bill that I'm co-sponsoring in California right now. And one of the things that I brought up with them is at the point of separation, you also don't really have a choice. Because if that separation is coming with health insurance and we're in the middle of a global health pandemic, are you just going to be like, you know what, I'm standing by my principle to not have health insurance during a pandemic, and so I'm not going to sign this? Or if it comes with any sort of severance, are you just going to figure out rent? And if you could, why were you working? Like, there isn't a choice that people are presented with. And often you're told you have to sign it. Mm. It's a conversation that's been coming up with Googlers recently. And they're in a special place of privilege where many of them are making quite a lot if they're full-time employees, although most of Google's employees globally are not full-time employees, they're contractors. But there was a conversation on Twitter yesterday about someone putting in their resignation, given like a bullet checklist of things that they're supposed to do after they've resigned. And one of them is they're told you have to sign these electronic separation documents. And you don't. Like, you don't have to, but if you're being fired, if you're being pushed out, if there's a situation where you're getting a severance as part of it, mm-hmm. you do have to sign it as a condition of getting it. Mm. And as part of the severance too, like, there's so many things that people don't realize go into this. I would not have looked as closely if I didn't have a lawyer and we weren't in a legal back and forth. But part of what you're signing and what they're really paying for is a release of claims. So any employee, and Google, other companies do this as a standard. As part of your exit agreement, you're basically signing away your right to sue them at any point going forward on anything, or to even participate in someone else's lawsuit. So at this point, because I signed the documentation, even though I've broken the NDA portion of it, they could sue me if I provided any sort of testimony or help to any employee who decided to sue them at any point going forward. Mm.
You alluded to this earlier, but I'd love for you to expand on it a bit. What effect, if any, do you think that Me Too and Black Lives Matter have had on the way that these NDAs kind of serve as corporate cover for illegal behavior?
Well, they always have, well before Me Too and the Black Lives Matter movement. I think what Me Too was super helpful for, and this really comes down to the individual women who broke their NDAs with the Weinstein Company, was having people see the language. It's one thing to say, you know, I have an NDA, it's a gag order. It's another to actually read how absolutely ridiculous the language is. I mean, the way they're written, sometimes specifically in the Weinstein case, and sometimes so broadly that you have to interpret it as being specific, you can't talk to family members about why you left. I had someone who reached out to me on Instagram recently saying that his partner used to work at a church. She left the church. He doesn't know what happened, but she signed an NDA and she's so scared about what she signed. She hasn't even told him, her partner, what exactly happened at the church. People use these, the Catholic Church has used them for a long time for exactly this reason. I don't know that that's what happened in her situation, but organizations of all types use them to keep wrongdoing out of the public view and to avoid accountability in a way that doesn't serve the institutions long term and doesn't actually help anyone. Because in the case of a publicly traded business, shareholders should be privy to information about illegal acts at the company, and they're not, because they have no idea.
Mm. And connected to that, it's when that person is written about. I mean, take Stormy Daniels, for instance. The whole world could tell her story, but she wasn't allowed to respond.
Yep.
And so the insipid nature of the whole thing is actually that you can't own your own experience as a human.
Yep.
Which is the most un-American thing there is. So yep. The biggest forces in our economy in this country, the biggest, are the ones that have really pushed through this concept and normalized the idea that we can own you forever.
Yep.
Even after we continue paying you. And so isn't this something that should be at the federal level, just completely banned, shut down, and retroactively dealt with? And also, are there enough examples of companies going after people for breaking their NDA that are in the public eye? Because that we never hear about. We never hear about an actual lawsuit about someone who's broken their NDA. Why?
Well, the Streisand effect. If you sue someone, and that's part of the gamble that people who break their NDAs take, that if the company sues you, then everything that they wanted to keep quiet then becomes part of the public record in the lawsuit. Because when all of those claims come out, I mean, there's so much. Part of the reason why I think Pinterest hasn't sued me is one, like, it'd just be absolutely ridiculous at this point. It would keep it in the news. But two, they are aware of everything that I'm aware of and everything I have documentation of. And they know that what has been reported on is not even 50% of it. So if we actually went to a lawsuit, then we could put it all in the public record.
So it's this funny in between.
It is. But here's the thing. I could afford a lawyer. I paid over $40,000 in legal fees, which is if I had a kid, if I had family I was supporting full time, there's no chance. Like, if I hadn't been in a position where I worked at companies and was able to save money as an individual, like, there's just no way I would have been able to afford it. And that's the bet that companies take, that people will sign them and people will keep them, because even if it's a frivolous lawsuit, you still have to hire counsel. You are almost always going to be paying out of pocket because there are very few lawyers who will take a case against a Google on contingency, because the chance that you win is slim, especially if you actually did break an agreement that you signed. And so it's just not a choice that many people can make. And that's why we will never actually know the scope of the use of NDAs like this, because by definition, they're secret. And so there's no way to tell who is signing them. I always wonder when I see a departure of a pretty major figure at a company, and there's no reasonable explanation for it, what they signed and how serious it was. And there's almost always documentation for it, even when the separation is announced as something else. And that was what happened in the former COO's case at Pinterest, where the CEO who fired her told the entire employee base that he was excited for whatever she was doing next. He loved the work that she did. Meanwhile, absolutely no one knew that actually she was dismissed. They've now paid her. Her settlement was $22.5 million because they were totally in the wrong. But he was willing to lie to employees about why she left and to shareholders.
So Senate Bill 331, tell me all about it and share with us what effect it may have on the national level if it goes through.
So it's a California state bill. I wish it were a federal bill, but our federal government is sort of dysfunctional. And so doing anything in Congress is difficult. And I say this as someone who's worked with many members of Congress who are, for the some part, fine people, but just can't get things done. This California State Senate bill, which is authored by Senator Connie Leyva, is called the Silence No More Act. And what it would do is expand those gender-based protections that I mentioned earlier to all forms of workplace and housing discrimination, harassment, and assault. And so if you're forced to sign an NDA, and in the housing context, basically, no one I talk to is aware that people often sign NDAs and leasing agreements, but many leasing agreements have NDA provisions, which is so gross when you think about it, because what is it that a landlord would need to protect themselves from in a discrimination or harassment or assault context? And yet they're there. What SB 331, the Silence No More Act, would do is allow anyone who's the victim of workplace or housing discrimination, harassment, or assault to talk about their experience regardless of what they sign, whether it's a non-disparagement clause or a non-disclosure agreement. And that's at any point. So whether it's at the leasing or start of employment point, or whether it's in a severance or separation agreement.
Do you think that there's a world in which that's a first step towards just an NDA just flat out being illegal?
I think so, but what I will be careful to say is that you can have non-disclosure agreements about IP, about trade secrets, whatever else, and they're still considered non-disclosure agreements, although they're usually titled confidentiality agreements because that's what they're about. But yeah, using them to silence people is, like you said, fundamentally un-American. And the fact that your speech rights can be taken by an employer forever should be so un-American and is not, I don't think, beneficial to the business community. And the argument that I've been making, especially when speaking to more conservative legislators and to folks who are business owners, is one, if you're running a business, you should want to know what's going on so you can address it. And two, if you're providing a severance, you're paying for the release of claims. You're paying the person not to sue you again. Why do you actually need to keep them silent? And then in how many situations are people actually sharing anything? Like, no one should have to live under the threat of bankruptcy or a lawsuit or whatever else. They should be able to just go about their lives as you have since you've separated employment with them.
Right. And I mean, let's face it, so often these are in place because for personal reasons.
Exactly.
People get fired over personal things.
Yep.
And that's what they don't want to release. It's never the trade secret. It's almost never the, you know, I shared the algorithm with the competitive company or whatever.
Right. And when it is, we hear about those cases. Mm-hmm. Like the guy who was at Waymo, I think, and mm-hmm. then went to Uber and took thousands of documents.
But Trump let him out.
Exactly.
Yeah. In his last, that was one of the last things he did for us.
You've now launched your own consulting business focused on tech accountability issues. Could you describe a little bit about what work you're doing and what are your aims with this work?
Yes. My consulting firm is called Earthseed, which is, I'm a science fiction super fan, and Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents books have a teaching that goes through them that is called Earthseed. And I mean, I'm doing my whole farming thing out here in Santa Fe now. But the focus of the work is, as you said, on tech accountability and in two areas. I'm continuing the health misinformation work that I've been doing, working on issues particularly around COVID, but also just trying to get people to understand that health misinformation is not new. And mm-hmm. if you want to address political misinformation, you have to understand the way that health misinformation works. Mm. None of it is random. It is almost always targeted. There are financial incentives behind most of it. One of the examples that I give is Alex Jones. He doesn't make most of his money from the shit that he spews. He makes it from the supplements and the other things that he sells to the people who are interested in whatever he's spewing on his talk shows or wherever he's hosting things now. That's the same with so many folks. They're selling mm-hmm. supplements. They're selling fake cures. It's the online version of snake oil salesmen.
Yeah, I mean, Alex Jones and Gwyneth Paltrow probably don't have a ton in common, but with this, they do.
They don't have a ton that's different, honestly, when it comes to health misinformation. And that's an argument that I made often, that if we're going to address at Pinterest, if we're going to address health misinformation and these quack doctors who are telling people not to vaccinate their kids, people who themselves are vaccinated, not to vaccinate their kids. How are we not addressing Goop? I think the folks over at Goop, whether it's their legal team or whoever else, has started paying attention because they've now hired MDs who provide advice on their site. So they're still selling all of the quackery, but now they have actual licensed doctors who are providing advice too. But the health misinformation is on one side, and then the other side of it is working on ways to support tech whistleblowers, because I don't believe there's accountability without transparency, and there can't be transparency without the people who take the risk on of being whistleblowers, and that risk shouldn't be borne only by them. So we need safety nets in place, whether it's providing people with help for health insurance, because healthcare tied to employment is a huge gag order. I mean, it's a silencing mechanism when you have to decide whether you're going to speak up and lose your health insurance and your kids' health insurance and your spouse's health insurance, or whether you're just going to keep your mouth shut and stay in your job, which many people do. And then just providing basic resources for whistleblowers and would-be whistleblowers. So, like, how do you even engage a law firm? I was in a special position when I decided to find legal counsel and when I decided to speak up, because my entire career has been working with lawyers, even though I'm not one. So I knew exactly who to reach out to, how to engage them, what the process would be like. I knew what working with someone on contingency versus fee-based would be. I had an idea of how much it would cost. At the partner level, you're looking at a minimum of $800 an hour. Which, when the hours start adding up, that's like something you need to think about as well.
And you don't want to save money on what level lawyer you get.
Oh, no, right. Like, you don't want a discount, but also you're like, can you give me a discount? Because what? And even how to work with reporters. So one of the things that I think is just so regrettable is that all you need is one bad reporter or one bad experience with a story for everyone in that person's network to decide, I can't ever talk to a reporter again. There have been a number of unfortunate examples of a combination of things. Tech employees not understanding what their relationship with a reporter is, and thinking that they were going to be kept anonymous or that the reporter had some sort of obligation to protect them, when that in fact is not the reporter's job. You're just a source and they have the responsibility to share the information with the public. And those have been enough to create this sense of, I don't know, battle between the media and tech. And the companies have done a really good job of using the same talking points, honestly, as the Trump administration, that journalists are the enemy of tech and they're just out to get tech companies and founders and tech employees. And so there's a lot of distrust there that I don't actually think is necessary. So just removing all of the ambiguity around the process. So what is your role as a source? Like, what does confidentiality mean? Can any outlet actually promise to keep you confidential or keep you anonymous? No, because once you share a few things, someone could figure out who you are. And then what the value is actually in sharing information and sharing it publicly, because there is some protection sometimes in going on the record with your name, because at least then if there's retaliation, it's not completely out of the public eye.
There's a responsibility for lawyers also in this space to shift and change and protect the people that they're working with and help them through this, because generally a lawyer is just going to go, yep, nope, no, you can't go near it. So then nothing moves forward, right? I mean, so are you thinking about the lawyer's responsibility also in this case?
Yeah, and part of what I'm putting together a set of resource guides for tech workers, and workers being both employees and contractors and anyone in the ecosystem. And part of what that's going to cover too is you could find a great lawyer who's not actually that great at working with whistleblowers because they have no experience working with the press. Their goal is to get you out of whatever the situation is as quickly and as cleanly as possible. And then there's some lawyers who don't want to be reported on. They don't want to have their name in reports. And so not only do you need to find an employment lawyer, you have to find someone who is comfortable with you speaking up and is comfortable with the risk that comes with that. Because once you speak up, they have a client now who has a target on their back. So I understand the approaches that many lawyers have to just completely avoid it. But I do think that if you're on the employee side and you care about employees' rights, that you should be more open to folks speaking up, because nothing is going to change without whistleblowers. Like, we would have no idea what's happening at Amazon right now without people who make basically minimum wage risking their jobs to speak up against a huge company that is more than willing to use all of its money and power against them. Mm.
As this conversation evolves, I'm wondering, do you expect we'll see greater fairness? Will there ever be more transparency and accountability from big tech? And connected to that, do these big tech congressional hearings even mean anything? Is it all just theater?
The hearings are pretty much just theater. Where I think they're helpful is getting folks on the record as liars. But at this point, like, does Mark actually care about lying? Like, I don't know that they care. And so I don't think that accountability will come from them. I doubt that it's going to come from the federal government. Where I think there's still an opportunity, though, for it to come is from employees. Because one of the things that Amazon, as much as Amazon hates unionization, hates organizing, whatever else, they understand how powerful it is, because they wouldn't be spending millions of dollars trying to stop it if they weren't keenly aware of it. So there's power still, I think, in the workforce. And so that's where my focus is, and less on any sort of legislative remedies. Like, we can't even get a federal data privacy law passed.
Well, I think it's interesting to remember too, these are obviously huge structures, huge organizations, but there's people behind them. And so I'm wondering, how responsible, in your mind, are the executives at these companies at the end of the day? And if they were held personally liable, would that help change things?
I think it would. And that's why one of the levers, I mean, as far as organizing goes, I sit a little differently than some folks in my opinion on this. I am all for shareholder lawsuits. I think that we use capitalism to fight bad and harmful capitalism. Like, I actually think that the kind of consequences that come from shareholders suing both the company and individuals, and that's why I love the Rhode Island Pension Fund's whole approach to this, where they named individuals both on the board and in executive positions, because they should be held personally responsible.
Yeah. Or seeing what's happened with the Sackler family, for example.
Well, yeah. I mean, they have not paid enough, and they have not actually been held personally responsible, in my opinion. All of the offshore money should, if they ever want to have residency in the U.S., I think that they should pay whatever money they sent out to Bermuda and wherever else they're hiding their funds. But in the case of Pinterest and other tech companies, if these executives are responsible enough that they're compensated for the authority they have and for the decision making that they're doing, why would they not also be held liable? Like, I don't understand how you get to have it both ways, where someone like Ben, who's the CEO, making more than anyone else, as he should as the CEO, is both in a position where he's responsible for making that money, but then also had no idea what was happening at his company. And, you know, how could he have known? His interview, I don't know if you guys read it, but his interview with Kara Swisher, I think, was one of the worst CEO interviews that I've seen, where you just are saying you're not responsible for anything that happens while you're still the CEO, then step down. If you can't be responsible, then who is?
I mean, this is something that is rampant in Silicon Valley. And it was born, when you really look at the genesis of this, I mean, you go back to the earliest days of the Valley, which were against the man and sort of this neoliberalism early, and Stuart Brand and Whole Earth Catalog, and this idea of sort of making your own reality. Well, making your own reality has gotten us here, and they continue to have their own reality, which is what this whole kind of moment is about. You know,
it's true.
You mentioned Mark Zuckerberg in front of Congress. He is speaking his own reality. I don't know if he would ever consider that lying. He's speaking his own reality in truth. And so this is, I mean, Adam Curtis does a great job of going into these things in his documentaries about what are the genesis of this? How did we get here? Well, it came out of this sort of late 60s idea of making your own reality.
Oof. Yeah. Yikes. I mean, I'm just thinking of when you said that, I was thinking of Lean In and that as a whole brand.
I don't even think we need to say more on that.
Making your own reality. Exactly. Nothing else to say.
So to finish, first of all, thank you so much for this incredible conversation and just how clearly you lay things out, which I think is so rarely done in this space. But as we finish, I just wanted to ask, what is your greatest hope as we emerge from this time? Because things are changing, right? The vaccine's rolling out. We're coming out of our lockdowns. What is your greatest hope broadly from all of this?
I don't know that we don't let another 500,000 Americans die because we can't admit that things are the way they are. I think it all goes back to the creating your own reality thing. All of it. The last year has been just so depressing. The fact that 500,000 people died and we're still not even considering universal healthcare for folks. The fact that a ton of people were laid off in the middle of a pandemic and no one at the federal level that I know of is questioning employer-tied healthcare. Like, there's so many things that feel basic that are not being addressed, which is why I got chickens, because, I just,
full circle.
Yeah, I just sometimes I need a checkout, and focusing on my chickens and my dogs is helpful.
It's fantastic. Thank you again so much for being here. This was really wonderful.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter, Exploring the Five Senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.